Siren Radio.
I see that Gibraltar has actually had its tourist board shortlisted for a tourism award. What have you got to say about that, Gabriella?
Yeah, it has been. I saw that as well. Yeah, good on them.
Exactly. Good on them. That's the important thing. It's just been shortlisted, but obviously it's a finalist in terms of tourism, so we'll just have to wait and see what happens. And you've also had Sir Vince Cable, I believe, wandering the streets of Gibraltar.
Poor Gibraltar.
You say that, Ben, clearly. I mean, I don't know, some might say blessed with Sir Vince Cable wandering the streets, shaking hands and so on.
That was just before the EU election, part of Lib Dem's campaign. So we had quite a few MEPs on the rock because we vote as part of the South West.
As opposed to being on the rocks, of course, which should be a different line or two. On the rock of Gibraltar, of course.
Although, why is it? Why I've got a question. Why is it southwest? Why would it not be southeast if you're in a southeast direction?
I have no idea. Oh. I don't know when it was done. It was done long before my time. But we've always been with that part. So
once again,
I guess it must be maybe the. I don't know, the constituency that had space to give to a rock.
I think sometimes
it's not done geographically.
I can see this is really...
done by, like, the population-wise. Maybe there were less people there, so they could stick in another 30,000 into the vote. I don't know. But I've just known it's always.
Or maybe provide another 30,000 people with the opportunity to exercise their franchise rather than stick another 30,000 into the vote. I mean, it sounds a bit clumsy, I think, basically, Gabriella. I expect more articulacy from you, as, of course, you deliver in every sense of the word. Melissa, what are we waiting for from Gabriella Peralta in Gibraltar now? It begins with W. Ends in R.
Weather?
Yes, exactly. Gabriella, that is your cue.
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 18 degrees centigrade, lows of 8 degrees centigrade, and it will be a day with sunny intervals and a moderate breeze.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
Have I had one of those days where you just feel it's difficult to go out of first gear? Okay, we'll get through it. That's the important thing. Gabriella, who do you wish to chat to? Do you wish to chat to the fabulous Melissa Wilde, the awesome Fergus Jeffs, or Ben Lewis, who has really only got another three Midweek Drive Morning Editions? Actually, it's another three, because next week, and then the week after that, it's the Lincolnshire Show. Might just be two Morning Editions, actually.
Not long left, no.
Yeah, and he's down in London for July. There's one at the end of June, no doubt.
Ben's leaving us.
I know.
Yes, exactly.
Oh my God!
There'll be more space on the radio for us.
Are you leaving us permanently?
I wouldn't say permanently because I'm sure Alex will have on at some point again. But yes, as of the studio based, yes, finished my degree.
Okay. So what are your plans?
I've got a new job in London. That's all sorted, finalised. So it's a case of moving down. I'll be starting on. At the 1st of July, so, not too long now. And
that's really exciting.
I know, in the real world.
Yeah, so this will be your first job then?
Effectively, yes. Besides, I mean, I've done the placement year and stuff like that, part-time jobs, but first full-time actual job, that'll be it.
Perhaps so career will be better.
That's probably the best phrase for it. But
so? I mean, as opposed to job. I mean, you're supposed to do job.
The start of my career. But I'm looking forward to it. It should be good. It should be really good.
And in what field would it be?
So it's in PR, but automotive PR. So it's a little section, which is obviously keep you busy at the minute, given all the news that's going around the car industry. But I'm looking forward to it. It's a nice challenge.
I wonder how long the car industry will actually stay in its current form, really.
Well, yeah, you say that, I mean, that
4 years.
Well, five, maybe. Months. But the electric industry will come in, and I think that'll be a big change as well. Mm. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
You say that, but we were all geared up to actually have a test drive at Silverstone yesterday in an electric car, and they just cancelled. I mean, that's hardly reliable, is it?
No. So, I remember they didn't have enough electricity or
yeah,
couldn't find the plugs.
Either way, we were geared up. We changed the whole thing around literally the night before. They phoned up and said, sorry, it's all off.
No reason.
No rhyme, no reason. Just it's, I'm not impressed. And I've obviously
probably just Googled us. And God, no, we're inviting these people.
Who knows? But anyway, life continues. Gabriella, who would you like to ask you the last two questions? Would it be Melissa? Would it be Fergus? Would it be Ben?
Ooh, I'm
going to
test Melissa.
Go, Melissa.
Have you had an enjoyable telephonic link with us today?
I have, thank you. It's been fun.
And will you be joining us again in the future?
Yeah, hopefully next week.
Hmm. Is it? I think she did quite well there, Gabrielle. What did you think? It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Good delivery. You know,
yeah.
Good
for
pose.
Sure.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, well done. Well done.
Weep for me, weep with me, weep for the planet. Talk about erasure. Should we actually erase people from history? Perhaps not. Should we just rewrite history? Is it just fake news? Is it ARD-TV? Is it Well-ARD-TV? Is it just ARD-TV? Is it Richard Fitzwilliams? Of course it is. Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Well, as can be expected. Of course, a memorable day with the ceremonies taking place in Normandy today, as you know, on the 75th anniversary of the beginning of the liberation of Western Europe, and I should be seeing Saving Private Ryan, which is specially showing in London, which was, of course, a movie that changed the genre. And we've had, as you know, a state visit.
Well, Fergus is nodding keenly when you mentioned Saving Private Ryan, because I think it's one of your favourites, Fergus, is that right?
Well, I was just commenting on the show yesterday that it's something that it ties very well into D-Day, because when you're at school and you're learning about D-Day, they show you the opening scene from it, which is obviously centred around D-Day.
I think that is something that's never before been matched in cinema. I mean, my father was used to enjoy a good film, and indeed, he was a gunner major during the war, and I took him to see it, and it was absolutely extraordinary, because he actually saw, as near as the cinema could possibly reenact, what he'd remembered. I mean, it was literally, film has never done that before. The sounds, the desaturated colour, the bullets and what they sounded like, the men sinking through the waves, explosions, the moving cameras. I mean, the whole thing was extraordinary, and I mean, I thought it. Since Saving Private Ryan, every film depicting war really has been different, depicting actual battle sequences. It really, really was groundbreaking.
Ben?
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's certainly one of the best films I think I've ever watched. But also the technicalities that were involved, particularly with when they were recording the sounds to people being shot, and I think it was dead cows they were using.
That's right, yes, the hides of cows, yes.
That was it.
Yes.
And then firing into those to get the same effect of the sound. It was just phenomenal, the amount of technicalities that went into the film.
Melissa?
As Spielberg says, every nation tells its own story, and this, of course, was a metaphor for the whole invasion set, of course, in Omaha Beach, an American film, but one surely to which we can all relate. It was in Omaha that by far the bloodiest fighting, and the extraordinary thing is 156,000 Allied troops launched in weather that, as we know, was unpredictable, and luckily there was this pivotal break. But against the Germans, it was a brilliant operation. I mean, the logistical scale of it, I was listening to historian Dan Snow painting some of the pictures that often we don't know about the scale of the backup required, the Mulberry Harbors, and how you supplied a force that, I mean, the Americans, 1.5 million were based in Britain during this period in the months to come, and it was absolutely phenomenal. No question also that on all five beaches, finally when the breakout occurred from Omaha, there was satisfactory progress. The Germans dug in, of course, around Caen and in the Normandy, in the fields and the hedgerows in Normandy. I mean, there's no question it was very, very bloody fighting. Until, of course, since they were led by a lunatic, Hitler ordered them to counterattack, and they were wiped out in the Falaise Gap episode. But there's absolutely no question that this was so pivotal, and to start the second front, because I mean, if D-Day had failed, luck also was on our side. It was Rommel's wife's birthday, and he believed the weather was so bad there was no chance of an Allied attack, and also, of course, a divided command with the sclerotic Prussian aristocrat Gert von Rundstedt. Rommel believed that the Allies had any chance of repelling the invasion, they had to be thrown back on the beaches. Von Rundstedt believed there was no way of knowing which where the attack would come, although the Germans thought it was Caen, so the panzers would be held in reserve and then used.
Yeah, they went there because they thought there was a film festival on, that's all.
Aha, well, that's it, you see. Everything played for the way the Allies handled it, and the security was just extraordinary.
So we have to ask the question, Emma, welcome to the programme. Have you seen Saving Private Ryan?
I haven't, actually, no. Oh. No.
This is... I really would recommend it.
Yeah. I will watch it. Yeah.
And Melissa, same question?
I've seen it, but it was a few years ago, so I don't really remember.
Oh. Well, I don't think so.
Well, it depicts wars no other film has, and no film, as I say, depicting war has been the same since because of the way Spielberg handled it.
Oh. I think the only closest film I can really sort of nail to it was All Quiet on the Western Front, which I think was probably great. I mean, it's probably the best World War One film there is, but certainly out of the... I think those two, out of those two wars, will mm-hmm. kind of be the best ones. I think we'll have to pick them.
All Quiet on the Western Front was remarkable. Oh, yes, indeed. And, of course, that, I think, was in the 1930s. Saving Private Ryan, one thinks of recently Hacksaw Ridge, and which was about heroism, so unbelievable. I mean, it was actually played down in the film because you wouldn't believe somebody, a conscientious objector, could achieve what he did. An amazing film, and also Letters from Iwo Jima, Clint Eastwood's film about the Japanese, the vain attempt, but heroic as he saw it, to defend against the American onslaught. It was really, there have been several. In fact, there are fewer war films these days simply because every single aspect of that World War II has been explored.
There'll be remakes, Richard. There are always remakes that'll be occurring from the time. I still have a hankering for A Bridge Too Far, but that's another issue for another time.
A Bridge Too Far, and this was The Longest Day, which I understand is showing again television today, which had this documentary edge as well as Too Many Heroics for Us Today, obviously. But I mean, the reason I paid tribute to The Longest Day was that it was full of little vignettes of the sort of extraordinary episodes that can happen in war, and it also filmed in black and white. And I remember when it first came out, and of course my parents were fascinated by it. I mean, the American heroics we wouldn't buy with John Wayne and Robert Mitchum today, but there's no doubt at all that the way the British and French sides were handled, and also the way the Germans were able to...
And, of course, the 1958 Dunkirk, as opposed to the one that was put together, which was an abomination recently.
I think that is a very cruel attack with you, but I think you're also being mischievous, Alex. Mm. You have that side to you,
please. Mischievous, Richard, we're going to take a musical break now, after which we will be sharing with the world the words, "Review the first ceremonial day of Trump's visit for CNN, a mesmerisingly magnificent state banquet, and an inspection of the senior regiment of foot in the British Army." That'll be happening. Plus, I believe there's a certain exhibition about an Egyptian who died long ago you want to talk about as well, from that point of view.
Yes, 3,000 years ago.
Richard, all that will be coming up after a view from Edwin Starr.
Say it again. Whoa. 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 listen to me. Oh. It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. Oh. I've got one friend, that's the Undertaker.
So I think it's fair to say it's high time that, just as with Bob Geldof, a knighthood is actually provided for Donald Trump because, well, let's face it, he deserves it after just entertaining everybody, despite having to deal with inflatables and various other bits and pieces. What a guy. And a blur of obviously seeing Farage and Johnson. Well, what can we say? Richard, what have you thought about the scenario? An exercise in soft power, I see.
Well, so far as, yes, you saw Farage, he didn't see Johnson, who I think thought that after
a 20-minute conversation,
a phone call, Johnson realised that he's absolutely toxic. But with reference to the ceremonial aspect, I mean, just to paint some of the background, my feeling was, I mean, since Woodrow Wilson came over, he was the first American president to pay a visit here to George the, he met George V in 1918, and there have only been two state visits by American presidents, and that was George W. Bush, very controversial after the Iraq War, again, a lot of protesters during Tony Blair's premiership, and Barack Obama's in 2011. My feeling was that, obviously, as our closest ally, I mean, an official visit, absolutely, I mean, you couldn't dispute that. At least I don't think you could. But Theresa May, of course, the moment Trump was elected, offered the state visit. She thought she could get Brexit through Parliament and then hoped...
She's thought a lot, hasn't she, Theresa, really? And sadly, none of what she's thought has really manifested in her or our particular world, shall we say.
I think you're right. I mean, it's quite a cruel thing to say because I thought she read the... piece yesterday in the commemoration in Portsmouth, the ceremony which was so moving, very well, but the facts of the matter are quite frankly...
Just because you can read something well, Richard, doesn't necessarily mean you should actually be running the country.
The reason I specifically mentioned it is that she put emotion into that reading, which has been totally lacking, or almost totally lacking, from her entire
But, Richard, she's a Maybot. That is the way she has operated.
Oh, that is precisely what comes across. And the extraordinary thing is that the Conservative Party didn't know it, or did not appear to know it, because Prime Minister's questions is quite one thing, where you can prepare your answers to be torn apart by Andrew Neil, for example, is quite another when you don't know what questions you're going to be asked. And, I mean, it has been... I quote the private eye list of her achievements, and it's a blank page.
Yes.
That's pretty cruel, but it sums it up.
The good thing is you can look forward to a debate on Channel 4, a televised debate between the battlers for the successor of Theresa May, and I'm sure that'll be great fun.
Well, one thing it will prove, Alex, is whether or not they can talk in public and they can actually extemporise. It really was extraordinary to
follow through on promises for a change.
I mean, as far as policies are concerned, Brexit has quite literally taken, as we all know, I mean, it's not making a political point to simply say that it's just taken over British politics. I mean, what we need, of course, is freedom from it, but I mean, how you get that in a parliament that can't make its mind up with people talking about no deal. I mean, just before I get to Alex's point about the ceremonial, Trump was talking, there were two incendiary interviews before what I thought was going to be an absolutely catastrophic state visit, one in the Sun and the other in the Sunday Times, not to mention tweets about the mayor who'd launched an attack. I mean, the mayor and Trump have been...
Stone cold loser.
Sadiq Khan and Donald Trump have been exchanging insults for about 3 years. And then, of course, there was Meghan and the word nasty and so forth. So everything pointed to a form of meltdown. But what happened, I think, the one thing it did prove, firstly, the wall-to-wall coverage showed people who, I mean, the 113th state visit that the Queen has played host to. And I think from the point of view of the royal family, the inspection for once went well of the Grenadier Guards. It's a senior regiment of the British Army, not the oldest, that's the Coldstream Guards, founded by General Monk in 1650. General Monk was, after Cromwell, brought Charles II back, and his guard in 1656 was that's when the Grenadiers were guard was formed, and that went well, and then there was the exchange of gifts. Apparently Trump is not the only head of state to have forgotten the gift he gave the Queen, although it was
he's got to deal with Korea, he's got to deal with China. It's not surprising he couldn't remember a horse. You know, that's just a model. I mean, there is a model of a horse.
I mean, yeah. The main thing, his mother...
Do you think he has advisors for that kind of thing?
Advisors, well, I mean, you tell me how long most of his advisors have lasted.
He's got a great wife.
His wife certainly looked very well in Dolce and Gabbana when she strode across Buckingham Palace lawn, I thought. I mean, it's interesting, actually, that I did a little piece for Elle, the quote, about why it was thought there's been some controversy over this. No one really knows why so many were dressed in white. I thought they looked very, very well at the state banquet, but... it's just one of these interesting things and a rather quirky coincidence, it seems. But the banquet itself, I mean, it takes months to prepare, three months before you send out invitations and the Queen personally inspects the table. But, I mean, this is a tradition that goes back, I mean, obviously to ancient times, but particularly to the field of the cloth of gold in 1520, because that's when Henry VIII and Francis I vied to put on those most spectacular possible show, and subsequently you've got this idea...
He was connected with Brexit as well. It was just a different kind of Brexit.
Now, that's a very important point. He was indeed. But I mean, one of the interesting aspects of it is if you actually read, you know, the courses and how the fact that the links with the Queen's estates, the Queen likes the personal touch and she inspects the table and so forth, and then the way, I mean, I can see how Obama tripped up because firstly there's the reception. You're presented to the Queen and the visiting head of state. Then you go into the ballroom, which has only been used, actually, since 1914 at Buckingham Palace, and then there is the royal procession, the royal national anthem, two verses. Then the ritual is Queen speaks, there's the national anthem of the head of state's country, and then there's the toast to the head of state and his or her country, and then it's the he or she stands up and gives a speech. Then there's the British national anthem, and then there is the toast, and then there are three courses in the banquet. Remember, you mustn't start before the Queen starts, and it's not done to continue after, well, if you do, your plate will be whisked away. Queen Victoria's Day, she wolfed the courses down, even though she ate so, as yet, vast amounts, so guests frequently couldn't finish.
She was probably just being mischievous, Richard, that's all. She just thought, how quick can I actually eat this? She probably gave herself great indigestion, which is why she was never amused. Just a thought.
Well, she actually had a great sense of humour. I can see you haven't been watching the Victoria on Sunday nights. I think it's great fun. But I would say that the other problem with Victoria's banquets was that she always had the windows open and guests froze.
Yeah, but it avoids flatulence problems, doesn't it? You know, I mean, if somebody actually at state dinner has an issue with respect to flatulence, you don't want to actually have to have the nosegays passed round. Silent but deadly can be terrible at a state occasion. Let's move on to quickly address this little thing from the team. Emma, were you concerned at all about Donald Trump's state visit? A lot of people were protesting in London. Was it a case of, he's okay, really? Or what were your thoughts?
I kind of forgot he was coming over, to be honest. That's how little I care, really, about him.
Spoken like a true Tottenham Hotspur supporter. over to Melissa, your thoughts?
I didn't know he was coming over until he was already here.
And then probably the best way, really. Yeah, he's just arrived. Ben, our man with the political finger on the pulse.
Yeah, I knew about it for a while. I think it was... Overall, I think it's been a success for him. I think he's behaved as well, and obviously there's a big thing about obviously his mother and his family are a big, huge royal family fans and...
In the words of Animesh Das, writing on Richard's timeline, critics always try to defame President Trump. I don't know why, to which Alistair Bywater replies, here's an example, protesters, I never saw any of them, must be fake news. He didn't see them because he was never driven past them. Surely he was told about them.
Extraordinary at that press conference where he... I mean, the point was he walked across from number 10 to the place where they're holding the press conference, and there was, half a dozen people could be heard. In fact, the main protest, which was far smaller than when he came over last year, was, of course, in Trafalgar Square. But the point, the one, this, his ambassador, Woody Johnson, because Trump stayed at Winfield House, not Buckingham Palace, which is being refurbished. Usually the Queen's guests stay at the palace, had raised this, fatefully raised the matter of the National Health Service being involved in any deal. Now, that was incendiary. The moment I heard that, I could see the headlines for the next day. Yeah.
Well, as Nate White, quoted by Neil Titley, actually points out, why do people not like British Trump? Why do people not like Donald Trump? Trump lacks certain qualities which the British traditionally esteem. For instance, he has no class, no charm, no coolness, no credibility, no compassion, no wit, no warmth, no wisdom, no subtlety, no sensitivity, no self-awareness, no humility, no honour, and no grace. All qualities, funnily enough, with which his predecessor, Mr. Obama, was generously blessed.
I would totally agree. I mean, there is no question, though, that fortunately he was on message. But this is the thing. Trump is so volatile and so unpredictable. Mm. If he, therefore, doesn't do anything outrageous or too outrageous, one is breathing a sigh of relief. So
would you agree that he's regarded as a Jabba the Hutt of privilege?
Well, I mean, there is absolutely no question that that is a colourful phrase. Mm. But I think... he's regarded with absolute horror by those who have or like diplomacy to be conducted in traditional ways, and also heads of state to behave in ways that one can appreciate, understand, and recognize. He simply doesn't. And that's what I'm afraid his power base, like in the United States, or a lot of them do, how he would get re-elected.
It already starts now, the campaign started for Trump 2020.
Yeah. Although, I mean, one of the aspects of this state visit, and the fact, this was, of course, fortunate, that it happened to coincide with the 75th anniversary, of course, of D-Day today, was in both speeches at the palace. So, and that I thought he did rather well. I mean, there's no doubt that, of course, the Queen, being the last surviving head of state who saw service in the war, there's absolutely no doubt that they both talked about the bonds between America and Britain, and also, of course, D-Day, and what an extraordinary operation it was and how successful. But Trump sees Britain standing alone. This is for him the nation state. He doesn't like or doesn't appreciate blocs such as the European Union. The Queen's speech, as has been pointed out, was far more nuanced, appreciating the institutions that have, like NATO, that have kept the peace and grown up since the war to keep the peace. You have a completely and totally unpredictable character. There's absolutely no doubt as well. The Mueller report, alleged links with Russia, comments.
Richard, let it go. Okay, let it go.
Oh, indeed.
Let it go. Ben, did you have any?
I was just going to say, Richard, do you think Trump has a certain level of respect for the Queen that he doesn't have for anyone else?
Mm.
The brief answer to that is yes. And remember, also, Trump respects, insofar as he respects others, he respects power. There was none in Theresa May because she was already a lame duck.
He spoke well of her, though, didn't he?
Speak
he
very
did speak
well
very
of
highly
he
of her.
Good negotiator. Didn't sue Europe, but, you know, obviously a tricky... maybe he was being ironic.
He did indeed, but remember, he does know. His mother was a great royalist, and he did appreciate that the Queen had the dignity and the experience. But there's no doubt that, I mean, we are in political chaos, and I mean, no one has any idea how this could be resolved.
But that's part of the fun. Finally, Fergus, any closing thoughts on Trump?
Well, I found it interesting that Prince William and Prince Harry were very, they weren't very keen to be seen with him. No. As soon as the photo
and Jeremy Corbyn didn't attend the Spetsnaz banquet, but actually asked to see him after all.
Really was extraordinary. I mean, firstly, Vince Cable also boycotted the state banquet. He's on the way out.
Yes, but he didn't. He didn't phone up and say, "Can I see you? Can I have a telephone call?"
No. I mean, this was rather odd that it came out at the same time that Corbyn was addressing the protests that he'd in fact asked to see Trump. I mean, it
beggars belief, Richard.
And then called out Trump anti-Semitism, which I found was quite ironic.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, if for any reason Corbyn became Prime Minister, he would simply have to deal with Trump, because Trump is the president, and it's a question simply of recognising realities.
It's all student politics.
Well, let's move on, because, Richard, we've got to take another musical break, and this is advice for Donald, certainly tying in with the next, third and final part of the trilogy. Of course, if you're a mummy, you can't really walk because you're so tied up in all sorts of ways, particularly if you're a young mummy and effectively you were killed as a young monarch and ended up in all sorts of other areas, probably being exhibited in Pompidou. What say you, Richard?
Well, I mean, if you become a pharaoh at 9 and die at 19, you would have a 10-year reign, and also you're terribly young and obviously controlled by those in the court who are in situ. I mean, Tutankhamun, just to paint the picture, going back 3,000 years, he was the son of Akhenaten, who was an extremely controversial pharaoh. He was notorious.
Like Donald Trump.
You could draw, sun worship. I mean, that's something you do, Alex, privately. I know this.
Newspaper, never have a word said against it.
Well, the trouble was, I mean, there'd always been, before Akhenaten, worship of the sun, but he made the worship of other gods. He banned it, and that was why, after his death and that of Tutankhamun,
Anubis would not have been happy.
Legacy was defaced. Mm. I mean, you won't find many artifacts linked to Akhenaten for this reason. Akhenaten married the famous Nefertiti, whose bust is in the museums in one of the museums in Berlin, which I've seen and is famous. But she was not Tutankhamun's mother. And when he ascended the throne, the capital went back to Thebes. Akhenaten had built his own, and you have had, he became, despite a 10-year reign, the most famous of pharaohs because of the extraordinary discovery, and you can see 150 of the artifacts that were discovered in 1922, the intrepid British explorer Howard Carter, backed by Lord Carnarvon, discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun. Robbers had broken in, but they'd been disturbed, and the glories, including, of course, the famous gold mask, which came over in 1972, which was an exhibition opened by the Queen, the treasures were still there, and it basically, when the exhibition opened at the British Museum, I mean, I remember queuing a couple of times for 4 hours, it changed the whole way museums display treasures here. What we subsequently found is the Blockbuster exhibition, and that's really, I think, fascinating, because you get a huge show and you also have a chance of appreciating an artist at a particular period of time, or indeed if you're looking at the Spanish artist Sorolla currently at the National Gallery, who I was only introduced to when on trips to Madrid, you have a look at someone's life, but you have it on a huge scale. Tutankhamun, as we're supposed to call him. I mean, at the Parc des Valets in Paris, they had the most glorious collection of artifacts. I do have to say that the throne hasn't left Egypt, and the gold mask, alas, cannot travel. This is one of the difficulties. Apparently, it's the last time that treasures are going to be sent around the world because of the frailty of the difficulties of travel and so forth. But there is an exquisite golden shrine. There's a floral unguent vase. There are gilded statuettes of the king. It's quite extraordinary. Amuletic colors and fabulous earrings. The god Horus. I mean, the gold is extraordinary, and there's an effigy of the king, and so much to appreciate, even if you are going, as I did, because it had opened. It is obviously tremendously popular, masses and masses of people. But some of the gods of Egypt and some of these absolutely amazing gilded statuettes and the glories of the colors of some of the amulets and necklaces. I mean, it really, really is absolutely staggering. And I would mention that it's coming here in November to the Saatchi Gallery, and it really is a must to book tickets for something that won't be repeated, even if some of the big treasures, the Guardians, as well, there were one of the Guardians who is so famous, was there in 1972 as well, and some of the, there was an animal headed throne with animal heads. Some of it can't travel, but this really, really was amazing.
Okay, let's just talk. Ben, you'll be in London then, presumably, unless, of course, you've done all sorts of other bits and pieces. Will you be checking out this exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery?
Oh, yeah, I'd like to. I've obviously enjoyed the visit the other day, so perhaps if I was able to fix something up with Richard, I'll certainly be able to explore it.
Oh, there we are, location reporter on that point.
I have to say that, I mean, I don't know how many tickets are still available, but really, really, this is something that, but it absolutely has to be seen, but also do take the opportunities whilst there are slots, if there are still left, because it attracts vast crowds.
Yeah. I mean, Richard, I won't be going. End of. I just think it's a strange and bizarre system, but let's go to Emma. Would you be checking it out? Or trying to?
I'll try to, yeah.
Melissa?
Probably not.
No. good choice. And, because of course, let's not go there. And Fergus?
I'm committed until it's from November till May next year.
You have to move very quickly. Yeah. Very important news. We need to acknowledge the fact that two fine folk actually are celebrating their arrival on the planet Earth today, one of whom, of course, is...
Good morning. I'm Liz Brewer, author of The Ultimate Guide to Party Planning and Etiquette. And you're listening to Ed and Jeff on the Saren FM Breakfast Show.
Ed and Jeff, of course.
It was quite
an old one.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought
my very best wishes to Liz, who's been a friend for many years.
Happy birthday to Liz Brewer, or as we like to say. Thank you.
This is Liz Brewer, the author of The Ultimate Guide to Party Planning and Etiquette, and you're listening to Alex Levchuk and the Midweek Drivettes on Saran 107.3 FM and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com.
See, in many ways, I feel that this brings a kind of regal aspect to the whole production. And so, I mean, and the parties at Red Royal Ascot are just legendary in so many ways. So happy birthday, Liz. We'll do the same for you, of course, Richard. We need to go another ident. And, of course, happy birthday to Tony Smith, who is also celebrating his birthday today.
Oh, Tony.
Yeah, happy birthday, Tony. Casey passes by the studio.
It's Rory's birthday as well.
Roy McGowan.
Just to mention, if you happen to be going into Paris, I would recommend an exhibition called Free History at the Pompidou Centre. It's absolutely fascinating because if you look at art, at the earliest art, and its connection with contemporary work, it really, really is rewarding. And artists such as Cezanne and Picasso and Klein and Klee and Chirico and Henry Moore and others have been inspired, and this is both by geological, the fossils, and also the earliest works, including, for example, art for the Cyclades.
Right, Richard. All done, all dusted, all signed, sealed and delivered, and indeed, happy birthday to Rory McGowan. Off times of this parish, probably to return in his second year. As you will, Emma, of course.
Yes,
and, of course, you're with us over summer. It's all good.
Yeah,
as indeed is Melissa.
Me.
No, it's all good. Richard, who would you like to ask you those last two questions? Fergus, Ben, Melissa or Emma?
Whichever you...
No, it's up to you, Richard. No, you need to make that decision. You need to go with us now.
Well, how about Ben?
Richard, very, very kind of you. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic limp for today on the show?
Yes, indeed I have.
Marvellous. And will you be joining us again next week?
Yes, indeed, and we should catch up on Booksmart then. I mean, it really, well, we couldn't put fit movies into the way the state...
We did Saving Private Ryan, we did various other war movies, for goodness sake.
We certainly did Saving Private Ryan, and that is, it's an iconic film, and it really, really is a must.
Richard, the Geordies are on their way.
Slipping down, slowly slipping down sideways. Think I'll sign off the door. 'Cause the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. Could a copper catch a crooked coffin maker? Could a copper comprehend that a crooked coffin maker's just an undertaker who undertakes to be a friend? And the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. Tell it to tomorrow, today will take its time to tell you what tonight will bring. Presently we'll have a pint or two together, everybody do their thing. Swing together, we can have a wee wee, we can have a wet on the wall. If someone slips a whisper that it's simple, sister, slap them down and slap it on their smalls. 'Cause the fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The
The fog on the Tyne is all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine. The fog on the Tyne is all mine, all mine.
Of course, the big question is, will Ian Lennox be humming along to that particular song? Will you, Ian?
Yes.
Is it all vine?
1970s.
Oh, well, you know, it's all sorts of wonderful things there. It would seem that Britain may be a nation heading towards 24/7 comfort. Half of British folk have admitted in a recent survey to wearing their pyjamas out and about. None of the Midweek Drivettes, I believe, are wearing pyjamas today. But, I mean, Emma, have you ever been tempted to actually stroll up just in your PJs?
No, I mean, I have popped to the shop sometimes in just a pyjama top, but wow. I put like a coat on or something. So you can't tell I'm in my pyjamas.
Mercy, you're a style guru, a fashion icon and so on. Are you a PJ person?
I love PJs, but I could never wear them outside the house.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Ben?
No, I think scruffy, you know, so-and-so's. I think they need to, you know, it takes 5 minutes to get dressed.
Over half of British folk admit to wearing their pyjamas when they go to the shops, when they walk their dog, when they're on conference calls, or indeed even in the office. And tomorrow is actually a day where we're being encouraged to wear our pyjamas. As I said to William Hanson, I'm going to be at a horse trials tomorrow. It's not going to be good. You can hear this in the interview after the news. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on pyjama wearing, Richard? Ian?
I've not got strong opinions, and if people want to wear them, let them wear them. They're not doing anybody else any harm, are they?
But doesn't it set a weak standard? Doesn't it set a sloppy standard? I mean, Fergus, would you ever dream of turning up to a lecture in your PJs?
I would. If I did, I would think it was a very bad dream.
I think a lot of people wore them as underclothes, didn't they?
Yeah.
And I used to have a sporter that I think who played golf. And used to wear
tank tops. I don't think they ever work really as a look. I mean, Melissa, tank tops, do they work? Do you think it's,
I don't know.
Occasionally.
Oh.
Depends who's wearing it.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, Bruce Willis, Ian Lennox, Zac Efron. It's difficult to sort of tell which one of those three you actually go for. Donald Trump. Anyway, I mean, have you been bothered by the visit, Ian, or is it just a case of it's passed you by?
I've not been bothered by it.
Well, never mind.
It's sort of strange, isn't it, really?
Well, strange is just the tip of the iceberg. Listen back to Richard Fitzwilliams and you'll have another epic view of the whole sort of side of things. Let us move on, Ian, because you are probably the sole person who can actually help Emma today. Because she's
poor Emma.
She's still... you know where we're going here with this, Ian, don't you?
No. Well, we're the worst, though.
We're going to Madrid. And we're going to the European Cup final. I know people might say, don't worry, England could beat Holland tonight and then go on to actually beat Portugal in the final, and then we'd have a trophy for the first time in over 53 years. Tottenham, on the other hand, from the opening moments. See what I did there?
4 seconds.
I mean, what? You know, I did say, playing Harry Kane, bad choice. Lose the match.
I think it's
this is at the final, was it?
Yeah. Did you not watch the European Cup final, Ian? I mean, I thought, you know.
Of course, yeah, but it was a disastrously bad decision, I think. The other guy who he dropped, I think he scored a hat trick in the semi final, didn't he?
Yeah.
And was really starting to play in the team, you know?
Yeah.
He had a different style of play to Kane, but I think he looked He looked what the fact was, and he hadn't played for a long, long time.
Exactly, absolutely. He actually epitomised a player who you may well recall, Ian, in the 1974 FA Cup final called Malcolm McDonald, where he also effectively was useless against Liverpool and also was thrashed 3-0. Not quite a thrashing, of course, was handed out by Watford recently, but that's by the by. You know, it's still one of those possibilities.
I was at that game, actually.
Yeah, well,
he wasn't alone in having a bad game.
And yet Keegan, who scored 2 goals, is now fated as a hero. You know, how astonishing is that? You know, it just shows the fickle nature of football fans.
I remember Newcastle, Mark McDonald's home debut at St James's Park, where he scored 3 goals and Keegan only scored one, I think.
Yeah, well, he came from Luton Town, of course, Malcolm McDonald.
Yeah, he started as a fullback, you know, a left back.
Are you, Emma, going to be on the Maurizio Pochettino, it's time you went? Are you going to say he's a loser, he's a serial loser, it's time he went to Manchester United?
No, God no,
really?
I love him. Yeah,
really?
I do.
Even though he's lost you through that, as Ian said, a horrendous decision.
He only made one bad decision.
Well,
look what he's done to the teams he's been at. Southampton, he's transformed them, he's transformed Spurs. But he hasn't made many bad buys, has he?
What have they won?
On a small budget.
What have they won? What silverware have they got? Claudio Ranieri at Leicester, you won something.
Yeah, and even Gary Lineker was asking why they'd hired him in the first place, and it was proven completely right. Yeah.
Gary Lineker, who I...
Well, I wish he comes in, if Ben Izzo goes, I hope he comes to Newcastle, that's all I can say.
Well, they have Rafa. You know, he's probably going to stick around.
Depends on whether a country buys them out and actually sort of shares their oil wealth with the whole thing. I mean, they've gone very quiet, Ian. Are you worried?
About what, sorry?
About Mike Ashley staying on for a few more years or decades.
Oh, God, don't. It's always lurking. I mean, I think we've been having... the third or fourth time he's been selling the club, I can't remember.
Well, as I said, not only was
this
I...
This one looks a little bit more promising.
I see, right. Well, as I say, not only was I in Manchester on Monday at the University of Manchester, but obviously took the time to actually visit the spiritual home Etihad, of course, as opposed to Main Road. And indeed, I actually have got a cheeky monkey, which I will introduce to Ben tomorrow, who I know you'll be delighted.
I'm not holding him.
He's got such long arms, he's great. It's just to sort of celebrate the joy of the Etihad Stadium, which of course is much beloved by Melissa's dad, which is great stuff. Who, Ian, would you like to ask you those last two questions? Would it be Fergus, would it be Ben, would it be Melissa, or would it be Emma?
Emma.
Okay. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, short but sweet.
And will you be joining us again next week?
I hope so.
The reason for the brevity, Ian, it's all on Richard Fitzwilliams, so you just have to take it up with him.
He
just would not stop, basically. He was on the Egyptians. He was on World War II.
Well, okay.
He was on the...
Fortunately, I'm not getting paid by the minute, though, so...
Yeah, and when he got started on Donald Trump, well, it was a whole new world, so we just...
I must have been diplomatic by comparison.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is why we felt we had to go in with Fog on the Tyne.
You're the Geordies.
It's all thine, quite rightly so. Even though I did actually mistake the parachutist for a Geordie when indeed he's Scots person.
Two very different accents.
You may say so, but there's a lot of similarities.
I thought the coverage on the news was very moving, actually, with the veterans, I think.
It was, and it's time for the news now, Ian. Fare thee well.
Okay. Siren
Radio. And the weather today, highs of 18 degrees centigrade, lows of 8 degrees centigrade, a day of sunny intervals with a moderate breeze.
And the sun was beating on the soldiers by the side of the road. There was a bright light, a shattering of shop windows. The bomb in the baby carriage was wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to a song. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry. It was a dry wind. And it swept across the desert and curled into the circle of blue. And the dead sand falling on the children, the mothers and the fathers and the automatic earth. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to us all. Oh yeah. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry.
It's a turnaround jump shot. It's everybody jump start. It's every generation throws a hero up the pop charts. Medicine is magical and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the babbling heart. And I believe these are days. Lasers in the jungle. Lasers in the jungle somewhere. Staccato signals of constant information, a loose affiliation of millionaires and billionaires and baby. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is a long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to us all, oh yeah. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in the corner of the sky. These are the days. Miracle and wonder, and don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry.
Ago, we were delighted to actually welcome the awesome individual whose name is Bobby Siegel his debut as far as Siren Radio is concerned. And we knew then he had to return in some way, shape or form. And he's gone one better, because in a story which actually focuses on parents actually being behind the curve on children's education, 64% of parents saying that they feel out of the loop when it comes to their child's learning. Not only do we have the awesomely talented teacher and academic Bobby Siegel. Good morning, Bobby.
Good morning, Alex.
But we also have the head of curriculum at Explore Learning, the awesomely wonderful Charlotte Gator. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. Bobby, would you like to come, if we come to you first in terms of this particular finding? I mean, is it just a case of there's so much technology there, we can't cope, we give it, oh, there's too much time, we can't help with our children at all, they're far too advanced of us, and that's age three.
Yeah, what I would say is that it's more just, like, again, my experience at Parents Evening is that a lot of parents come will say, oh, I'm really confused. I don't know what's going on. They feel that the curriculum's changing all the time. And then because of that, parents often like disengage, go, oh, I'm not sure what's going on in the education. So it's trying to make sure that parents don't feel afraid, don't feel as if they can't communicate with their school or engage with their kids' education. Because obviously, again, our research shows that being engaged with kids' education is incredibly important for the kids' success.
I was really amazed to find that 91% of parents feel that today's teaching methods are unnecessarily complicated. I mean, Charlotte, how does Explore Learning effectively cut through all that and actually say, look, it's simple, it's effective, we haven't changed our DNA biological makeup. As human beings, we still have certain good habits that we get into when it comes to learning.
I think what we do at Explore Learning is we support families with the changes and explain those changes to the parents so that they don't feel scared and nervous about the changes. I think lots of parents think things are complicated, but actually sometimes it's just that terminology's changed. So when I was at school, we learnt about magic E's, changing sounds in words. Now they're called split digraphs. So a parent might see that term and think, I've got no idea what that means. But what we can do is explain where that's come from and just how the terminology has changed.
Well, I know from a mathematical point of view, and Bobby, you probably have lots of things to say about this, that there was a vogue back in the day when we were looking into new mathematics, we were looking at Venn diagrams and various other aspects, and then we sort of said, no, we weren't reading, writing, arithmetic, we want it sort of basic from that point of view. And it does seem, I mean, Cuisenaire rods, you probably don't even remember those long sort of ways of the solid routines. You know, education does tend to change, but is it a case of the fundamentals do remain the same?
Yeah, I would say that's completely right in terms of the assessment, because, again, if you look at multiplication, you know, the method that most of us would learn is the column method. You know, you line the numbers up with the tens and the units. But then at some stage, grid, where you line up like almost like a noughts and crosses style, like 52 times 17.
You see, that loses me. You see, I mean, grid, I mean, I can long division, fine. Multiplication, fine. But, you know, it's this sort of way. And sometimes, maybe is that at the heart of sometimes where parents think, but you don't do it like that, you do it like this.
Yes, I think parents sometimes, when they see a new method, they maybe feel a bit embarrassed. Oh, how comes my child knows it and I don't? But I think the key thing is telling parents, you know, it's okay that you've not seen it, but make sure you try and find out what it is. It could be through the school's website. It could be going and speaking to people at Explore Learning. But making sure that you've got that confidence to go and ask the question. Don't just say, oh, I've never seen this method, I'm going to disengage.
Before I moved up to, I say moved up, let's move, moved into higher education, teaching and working as a university academic, I did 2 or 3 years, actually, in comprehensive education, etc. And one of the buzzwords there was very much partnerships, partnerships between teachers, between parents, between children. So it's a three-way package. Is that something, Charlotte, which is, again, still very much at the heart of obviously, Explore Learning, that you need that, not necessarily contractual obligation, but you need that partnership to really ensure all sides benefit?
Yes, definitely. I don't think a child can benefit just in one setting, in one place, if they're just doing things at school separately from what they're doing at home and what they're doing in settings like Explore Learning. If we don't have that partnership and everyone working together, then it can be confusing for the different parties. So I think everybody working together to support a child means that they can really flourish.
We were having a debate yesterday on the Midweek Drive about the correct plural for octopus. Is it octopedes, octopub, octopodes? Is it octopi and so on? Which, I mean, people were arguing, go back to the ancient Greek and so on. That's where you actually use, look from that. But what about terms like academization and aspects with respect to that? Is it sometimes a case of, you know, despite the attempts to actually keep it simple, sometimes as human beings we overcomplicate?
I think things need a term, and I think actually sometimes that makes things more simple, because if you're trying to explain what academization is without giving it a word, it becomes really convoluted. And so I think if we can learn the names of dinosaurs and 5- and 6-year-olds can point out what the different dinosaurs are, then we can certainly learn what things like partitioning and academization mean.
The naming of names, as Elliot Avant said, but he was referring to cats as far as I go through there. Bobby, in terms of finding out further information about this extraordinary world, where would you point people?
So I'd say three things. Firstly, head to your school's website, because that will tell you what the school does in terms of their teaching methods and curriculum. Secondly, I would say head to the explorelearning.co.uk site, because there's great advice there, blogs that are useful for parents. And then thirdly, I'd say gov.uk, because this will have a breakdown of, depending on which year group your child is, what the curriculum is. So I'd say those three things: your school website, explorelearning.co.uk, and .gov.uk.
That makes perfect sense, which is good. You can always play the podcast back, or indeed the radio programme will be manifestly online for a whole variety of other elements as well. Got to ask the two critical questions to both of you, though. Charlotte first, do you feel that the standard of education is actually improving, or are we into that whole notion of, oh, it was a lot more difficult when I was at school, etc., etc., or is that just something that happens with generation after generation?
I think that definitely happens with generation to generation. Kind of the grass is always greener. I think that there's been a lot of developments. Teachers get really good training now. There's lots of resources available to schools when they can afford them, which means that the standards are getting better and better. So, yeah, I think that we continue to improve the education system.
And I'm sure that the words amongst many undergraduates will have actually been said oft times. But I'm no Bobby Siegel, or who do you think I am, Bobby Siegel, etc. I mean, what about yourself, Bobby? Are we on a, despite all the pressures, despite all the sort of challenges that we're faced with, despite all sometimes the political leaders that we're also provided with, do we feel as though actually we are on an improving road?
Absolutely. Again, there's more scrutiny nowadays that teachers 20 years ago could do what they want in a lesson without any accountability. So I think, on the whole, I think that literacy, numeracy, there's a better standard of education being offered out there.
I'm not sure whether there was no accountability whatsoever 20 years ago.
Yeah,
I think I'll just rephrase that slightly.
Yeah.
A bit of revisionist history coming into place there, really, Bobby. So just to ease back on that. But awesome. Bobby Siegel and Charlotte Gator, many, many thanks indeed. Hopefully we'll speak again soon and keep us more appraised of how exciting education developments are continuing to impact on our lives.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
Now, one of the phenomena that seems to have occurred when it comes to sartorial elegance or not over the last 10, 15 years or thereabouts are the number of folk who tend to actually start wearing their pyjamas out and about, including to the shops, walking the dog, conference calls, and so on and so forth. The study that we're referring to is actually by Book Trust, the UK's largest children's reading charity, and it does suggest that, when it comes to pyjamas, we might be obsessed with them. Now, clearly, as we actually head to the joys of the 7th of June Pyjama-rama campaign, who better to actually discuss the notions of sartorial elegance and, indeed, probably exercising decorum as well than etiquette expert extraordinaire, it's William Hanson. How are you, William?
I'm very well, Alex, and you?
Excellent. Well, I'm not wearing pyjamas, and I have to say...
But I hope you will be on Pyjama-rama Day on Friday.
Do you know, it's an interesting one, because on Friday I'm scheduled to be at the Equitrek Brabham International Horse Trials, and somehow I just feel that, you know, it may be sending out all of the wrong messages to the runners and riders, the competitors, the exhibitors there. I'm just thinking, you know, Zara Tindall might be there, you know, doing an interview in pyjamas. It's
well,
not
you could
work.
Get her involved. Come on, you're missing out. Zara looks gorgeous in a wincy at nightgown.
William, I shall take those words and use them as a quote quite clearly from that point of view.
You tell her I told you.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why we just are obsessed with pyjamas as opposed to other forms of bedroom apparel and so on.
Well, I think they are so comfortable. I mean, certainly if like me, you have a very nice pair, or several pairs, then they are comfortable. You are cocooned in them. They can make you feel relaxed. And however stressful your day might have been, once you slip into those pyjamas, you do psychologically begin to relax. Everything's going to be fine. Same as if you put on a suit. You start thinking, formal dress. I've got to think in a different way. I can remember, you know, eons ago when I was revising for exams, it was very hard for me to revise in casual wear. I popped my school uniform on, even though it was on Easter holidays. I revised slightly better. Still didn't do very well, but I felt like I revised a little bit better. It can affect our mindset. So I think Brits, and we are still a fairly formal society, not quite as formal as we were, but I think Brits do like that, you know, for however sort of slightly more formal we are, we always are going to like our home comforts.
Wouldn't a caftan be more suited if you're looking for external wear? I mean, that was something which was very popular a few years ago, I seem to recall.
Yes, quite a few years ago. I mean, you can always wear that. I mean, you can wear your caftan on Friday. That's not a problem. Anything that you wear to bed, as long as you do wear something to bed, of course.
Well, precisely. There's a whole range of issues there. As indeed, I suppose, probably one of the most well-known international pyjama wearers, who is, I think, known for his, I won't say addiction, but certainly fondness for pyjama wear, was Hugh Hefner, of course, the founder of the Playboy empire, which, again, probably in these contemporary climate days might sort of be sending all sorts of the wrong messages.
Well, yes, but you see, if on Friday people ask you why you're in your pyjamas, you're going to tell them, of course, it is for the Book Trust Pyjama-rama campaign. It's a charity, so it's okay. Friday is probably, arguably, one of the most socially acceptable times it is to wear your pyjamas outside of your own house, as long as, obviously, it's a fresh set. I'm not necessarily suggesting that you wear out on Friday the pyjamas you wore to bed on Thursday. You could put on a fresh set and still look fairly decent.
Well, as you rightly said, this is all thanks to the joys of the Book Trust, and they're also asking people to donate £1, a single English pound, 100 English pennies, to celebrate Pyjama-rama, a national fundraising campaign to help the target of reaching more children with books and reading. Who would be your favourite character to actually dress up in pyjamas, William? I mean, would it be Winnie the Pooh? Would it be, I don't know, something more?
Well, Winnie the Pooh only really wore a T-shirt.
This is true, exactly.
Yeah. So I probably, Rupert the Bear.
Yes.
Was a nice character.
Yeah.
What other books did I love reading? Well, the Mary Poppins books I always love. They're my favourite children's books. And in fact, I'm rereading one of them at the moment.
I'm not sure that even Miss Travers would actually sort of have issues with respect to Mary Poppins in a nightdress or a negligee, really.
Well, I don't think we'd ever see Mary Poppins in a nightdress. I mean, that is going a bit too far. But indeed, Jane and Michael Banks, Annabelle and the twins, they did go, they had adventures in the moon in their pyjamas, so they left the house for in their pyjamas.
And I suppose you could argue that the Peter Pan adventurers, they were pretty much in their pyjamas when they actually hied off to Neverland, really.
Absolutely. So that, you know, they've been pyjamas, I think, play a huge part in children's literature.
Hmm. Casual T-shirt and shorts don't score highly in terms of the pyjama routine. I mean, effectively, the whole notion of what people wear or don't wear. I mean, we mentioned obviously wearing something. 17% apparently do the birthday suit routine from that perspective. I mean, would you say that pyjamas, effectively, the 21st century is still very much made for the traditional pyjama?
I think so, and clearly this research is showing that. Obviously, as I say, if you're wearing them in public, fresh set, looking presentable, nothing skimpy or made of lace. You know, it's not supposed to be a fashion parade, but you have got to look fairly decent. Oh. And you can still brush your hair, look smart, wash, shower on Friday. Just because you're in your pyjamas doesn't mean to say the rest of you has to be overly casual.
Well, I'm pleased you said that, William, because, again, it is one of my minor bugbears that seems to be permeating a whole range of towns and cities. I mean, I've seen it occurring in Middlesbrough, I've seen it occurring in Lincoln, I've seen it occurring in even Manchester, where effectively people are getting into their pyjamas. I'm thinking, no, just it's, you need to get into, as you say, you need to get into a wake-up mode, etc. It's going to lead to indolence and all sorts of challenges.
Yes, absolutely. So, but if you have ever wanted to leave the house in your pyjamas, if you've ever wanted to...
This is the day for you, clearly.
Yeah, if you want to trip around Waterside Shopping Centre in your pyjamas, this is the time to do it.
Well, William, you could not have actually sort of expressed the whole concept more clearly from the point of view of Pyjama-rama Day this coming Friday, the 7th of June, the Pyjama-rama campaign in association, obviously, with the Book Trust. A couple of final questions, William. Where can people go to find out further details about the Book Trust? Would it actually be just typing in Book Trust into the search engine and seeing what magic emerged?
Indeed. Booktrust.org.uk.
And your favourite style of pyjama? Would it be one with top pockets, or would it be striped pyjamas, single-colour pyjamas?
Yes, there is a top pocket. Yeah. Well, I have a range. The ones I'm going to be wearing on Friday, they're a lovely spy pyjamas set. They're sort of a nice sort of tealy green twin set. So they're not, so brushed cotton, very soft.
And any particular occasions? I mean, should we check out the social calendar in the Times to see where you might be wearing this particular pyjama set?
Well, who knows? I mean, it won't be at horse trials, it'll be somewhere suitably elegant.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't agreed to do this, William. So let's just hold it there. I would say it's in the unlikely category at this stage.
It's on the record now.
William Hanson, it's been fantastic sharing some of the good thoughts with your good self. We will speak again soon, I've no doubt. Take care now.
And from William Hanson and his pyjamas, we turn to a gentleman I'm sure we'll have. Well, we won't, because he's actually out of signal range. There we are. He's obviously so shocked with respect to that William Sitwell clearly just went momentarily out of signal range. Shall we? Oh, there we are. Pyjamas going in all sorts of ways there. There we are. What shall we do? Shall we actually try and contact William and see if he gets that?
Do you want to pop some music on for that?
Do you think so?
Almost like hold music.
Yeah, I don't like to give the siren radio
a little bit of LR18 music.
You can do a little live a cappella hold music and see what happens with respect to that. But, you know, we can only sort of try and see what actually happens. And after that, of course, we have Lisa Faulkner. Hopefully he'll be speaking with us. But if he is going into a bad signal range, well, we don't really know. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, maybe it won't.
Your call cannot be
completed. Yeah, see, there we are. That might have been a misdialing, so we'll keep the excitement going just a wee while to find out what's there. In case people are wondering, why didn't they actually see, if they particularly telegraph on a Saturday, why didn't they see William Sitwell's line there? Well, it wasn't in last Saturday because they were having a D-Day special. So I just wanted to clarify that in terms of people who are wondering what would be William weighing in on as far as events and things were actually concerned, Saturday. So this is the second attempt to see if anything's coming through at this particular stage. Oh, silence. Not looking good, is it? Still, Martin Raymond, the co-founder of the Future Laboratory, is hopefully lined up to do a few bits and pieces, etc. Looks as though we could be going into a variety of other key things as well. We don't seem to be actually getting any sort of message at all there, so...
This is a recording.
Yeah. Clearly, that's it. It's a recording. It's gone. Well, you know, such is life. We had hoped that William would have been able to talk us through to Lisa Faulkner, who's going to talk about irresponsible dog owners in a few moments' time. Still, it's time to know that it is June. It is wonderful weather in Lincoln. It will continue to be so for the next 5 or 6 hours at least. And I think the sun's rising. Or has risen. It's coming round the corner. Literally, we're heading into June, flaming June, no doubt, and a whole variety of other bits and pieces. But what about the sort of things that we do in June and various other sort of bits and pieces? Well, probably the best person when it comes to talking about trends and coordinating that has to be, from Amazon, of course, the amazingly wonderful Martin Raymond. Good morning, Martin. How are you?
Good morning, sir. Indeed, it's going to be a very hot June. We're looking at, I think it's 27 degrees over the weekend. Quite startling.
It's sizzling. So is it a case of suddenly we'll all be expecting the parcel delivery services to be bringing us our barbecues, our sun cream, our tanning lotions and so on? Or are we going somewhere else?
Well, actually, we're seeing quite a lot of new trends coming in, some of them nostalgic. So, for example, we've seen, looking at kind of Amazon statistics, a huge uptake in things like outdoor projectors, LED screens, which means that we can extend our viewing from night to day, so we're still outdoors at this point, but also, interestingly enough, a focus on a renewed sense of freshness, so fresh food, wild vegetables, plant-based cuisine. So the current trend for, you know, vegan, vegetarian has really translated to a lot of the things we're buying over the summer. So we're seeing a huge uptake in not just vegetables and kind of plants generally, but would you believe things like aquaponic kits for the home? So it's literally taking vegetables, fish, and growing them right next to the place where you're going to cook them. So really what we're seeing is a whole sense of how the UK summer is shifting into a much different sense of tradition for 2019.
Well, as you say, 21st century from that point of view, which is one of the reasons why, you know, writing books like The Tomorrow People and The Trend Forecaster's Handbook, is you are the go-to person. Is this like a one-stop shop then? I mean, are we looking for ecological friendliness that it all fits together?
Yeah, it's a lot of I think, trends that have been coming together. So if you think, for example, you know, millennials, that kind of group are now in their mid-30s, you know, they're thinking about families. But rather than, you know, having a child first, they're actually going out and buying themselves a cat or a dog and pretty much treating them in the same way that you would treat your child. Well, maybe not instantly, because, for example, we're seeing the uptake of rosé and beer for our pets. A lot of pampering products. We like to pamper each other. But what about buying a Podicure nail polish for your dog or cat? You know, 188% year-on-year increase in those kind of products. So really what we're seeing is how we're kind of testing boundaries in different ways. And summer, of course, you know, kind of moment when most of us are smiling, it's probably the place. That's why all of these trends are kind of coming together. You know, the outdoors, freshness, the notion of, you know, pampering and wellness and looking after yourselves, all happens better when the sun is shining.
I personally have a fondness sometimes for the increasing vogue for robotic pets, because you don't have to worry too much about their well-being, although up to a point you have to. Is that something which, when we actually are watching dog and cat reality TV programmes on Prime Video, actually we might sort of like to have a friend who might be Hammy the Talky Hamster, for instance?
You know, to be fair, as with all things, I always look at on Amazon, and it always tells me two things. One is what's trending, mm-hmm. and the other are the anomalies. And I think we're beginning to see acceptance of things like, you know, robots. The fact that I can have Alexa in my home and you know, children talk to her as if, and, you know, to every extent and purpose, you know, they sound like real people, real things. So I think increasingly our sense of how the robot is slipping into our home has become part of how we understand tomorrow will be. But I also think that nostalgia kick back to the outdoor projector, you know, the games like Movieoke, you know, where we play our favourite movies, our musicals rather, and sing along with them outdoor, are all of those things that likewise connect us to the past. So I think it's one of those things where we ground ourselves in the now and then we look to see what's new and next. And really, you know, this report, which is available at the moment, like Smile at Summer Trend Report, it really does show us what's making us smile. And I think, you know, unusually, it's the things that we are familiar with, but also, for example, exercise. Who would have thought that exercise would make us smile? And yet, quite a lot of families across generations are getting together to exercise together. So again, this notion of well-being and happiness and keeping a smile isn't just about indulgence. It is about making us feel better physically so we begin to feel better mentally. And that was one of the key trends that we picked up on, is what we're calling Fit Fam. The notion that families, not just individuals, families are getting together to exercise together so that collectively they can feel better about how their summer will shape up.
You see, clearly, when you founded Videographic, when you've been an associate editor at Screen International and lectured at the London College of Fashion, you're on the case, Martin. I mean, it goes without saying. I'm just intrigued by the coral pink notion that, is it all things coral pink? I mean, is that where we should be going, that, you know, we can't have real men not wearing coral pink? You should be wearing coral pink.
Do you know, I think real men look great in coral pink, and it's one of those colours for summer, which you're going to see everywhere. It's because we're celebrating a unique time of year, and pink, as anybody who studies colour psychology, and I've had to do this in the past myself, pink is one of those bright, jovial, positive, optimistic colours that everybody loves. I mean, if you show somebody pink, they start smiling. It's one of those colours that make us smile. And weirdly, pink is used as a calming colour. So in stressful situations, the colour pink is brought out to calm people down. I think that was the other thing that came out of the Amazon report, is that it's the slightly odd things that remind us of just how different and amusing our summers can be. So that coral pink, now that I've mentioned it, it's going to be a bit like when you have a friend who's pregnant, suddenly everybody seems to be having a baby, and it's going to be like that for summer when you see pink. Everything will be pink, including the beaches, including the cushions you're sitting in, including some of the foods you're going to eat. And dare I say it, pet ice cream, which is also done in a pink flavour. So your dog may even be eating
it. It's too much information, Martin. Too much information. I mean, please. You know, that's really, let's take it to ridiculous. Hashtag Smile It Summer, of course, is the trend report commissioned by Amazon, developed by the Future Laboratory. We've been speaking to the co-founder, of course, of the Future Laboratory and editor-in-chief of LSN Global. Martin, have you had a reasonably interesting and fashionable telephonic link with us today?
idea I had, and it's already tickled me pink to have that conversation with you there. I thought I'd get that in just before we go.
Genius. This is so just a reminder, where can people go to find out further details about this survey and more?
That's literally, it's amazon.co.uk/smile. It's summer, and it really will make you smile when you see some of the things on the list.
Martin, we need to ask you as well, will you return and keep us appraised of, I don't know, future trends in the autumn, perhaps?
I'd love to. I think autumn is a great alternative switch, and what you tend to see are trends that really get you ready and prep for the oncoming winter. So perhaps not pink, more like an indigo blue is probably the colour we're going to see for autumn winter.
I'll go with that. Martin Raymond, co-founder of the Future Laboratory, many thanks indeed.
Our pleasure, sir.
Melissa, coral pink for summer. Is it a happening thing? I mean, you've got the jumper there, which is pinkish, really.
It's red.
Well, it's darker shade of pink. Okay.
There's nothing pink about it.
Yeah, it's quite...
Does it appeal, though, coral pink?
I guess, a bit.
Okay, Fergus?
I like bright pink.
Bright pink. Fergus, are you coral pink or bright pink? Or not pink at all?
Not really.
Not pink at all. More kind of grey person, really.
No, I'm more of a blue.
Blue?
Person, yeah.
Dark blue, as in Leicester?
More towards the dark blues, yeah.
No preference?
No. Emma?
I like pink.
Right. So
she's wearing a pink dress.
Pink, definitely pink. The average dog is being overfed by 54,000 calories a year, it would seem, which is the equivalent of a human being eating 340 cheeseburgers. Almost half of dog owners say that they don't care that much about dog obesity, and over a third of dog owners incorrectly think that dogs should get treats most days. You're a dog walker, Emma. I mean, is this something which sends fear through your whole system? And have you ever fed burgers, cake or ice cream to your dog?
No. No, I don't think I've fed any of those things.
Most calorific foods dog owners have admitted to feeding in the past 6 months. Crisps, sausage rolls, hot dogs, cake, ice cream, shepherd's pie, Chinese takeaways.
just treat them like one of the family.
It's not like a chihuahua, is it, really, from that point of view? And almost a quarter of pet owners have also admitted that they've given their dog chocolate before, while 15% have even given their pup...
That's
not
even healthy.
No, exactly. Do not do that. 15% have also given their pup chewing gum.
Why?
And almost half of pet owners have also fed their dog a Sunday roast in the past.
Oh, my word.
Oh, that's okay.
Oh, my
God.
So we're okay with the Sunday roast.
Okay. Yeah. That's a bit of meat, isn't it?
Well, you may well say that. We will hopefully speak to Lisa Faulkner about her concern about irresponsible pet owners. And the other story which we're looking to feature is Justin Donnelly, former army officer, a specialist in psychological operations, in which he has also said that 2/3 of the British public think they're good at obtaining vital information from people without having to ask. What do you think, from your journalism aspects, Fergus? Do you think you're good at obtaining vital information from people without having to ask?
Well, it depends which avenues you want to go down, really. I mean, you obviously
you could tell me, but you'd have to kill me.
It's a need to know.
You have ways of making a talk. That's another way. Melissa, could you have a ways of winkling out interesting secrets and elements from that point of view?
Sometimes I just pretend like you don't want to know, and then they'll probably tell you.
You see, that's the classic Mata Hari approach. And Emma, needless to say, obviously you know everything about everything, really. So
Yeah.
Okay, still to come, and it is 9:38, so it's 22 minutes to the joys of 10 a.m. here as Siren Radio is concerned. Little heads up, later on this evening, 7 o'clock, another edition of Sound and Country Vision with Tessa Snart and her sister Lois. Don't let yourself be hurt this time. Probably best known as the themed Twin Peaks, one of Phil Leonis's all-time favourite TV shows, and Julie Cruz with Falling, as well as, of course, the movie, which also fell in its own way. Just in case you're wondering, you're listening to the Midweek Drive, we have in the studio Fergus, we have Ben, we have Melissa, and we also have Emma. They can answer any questions whatsoever, as they'll prove over the next 1,800 or so seconds that we've got remaining on the whole production. When, fingers crossed, we might feature one, well, we might feature two individuals who are coming through. Still, let's go for some advice courtesy of Doris Day. We need to know why we shouldn't eat the daisies. Well, maybe not. Let's talk spies or not, or everyday espionage, with respect to two-thirds of the British public believing that they're good at obtaining information from people without directly having to ask, which suggests that actually 33 million British folk may have what it takes to step into the shoes of the spy game. Now, to talk about this, who better than former army officer and specialist in psychological operations, the awesome Justin Donnelly. How are you, Justin?
Very good, thank you. Good morning.
Excellent. We've got four fine folk in the studio, any one of whom could, of course, proceed from their postgraduate or undergraduate work to the spy game. We couldn't obviously say in any way, shape or form. And I believe, Ben, you've already got a question you want to put to Justin.
Oh,
Yeah, well, it's just it's slightly separate to the whole task we've got here today. Oh. But just in general, I remember the MI5 stuff, and well, I remember being in secondary school, and an interesting way of recruiting people. I think they resorted to putting out a puzzle on their website and stuff like that. Always found it quite interesting, and whether it was a good source of finding good people.
A puzzle on the website, would that also feature in Fox's Deep State program? What say you, Justin?
Well, it's a very good point, and I think what you've identified there is a truth about what it is to be a spy. I think, you know, we're not talking about people with superhuman skills. We're actually talking about very ordinary human skills. So being able to be analytical, being able to solve a problem, being able to observe a situation and gather information, these are all very normal, natural human skills. So what the intelligence agencies often do is they have to scour the country to identify people with those skills, and they want the very best.
Now, we're also here to talk a little bit about a new series of Deep State. It's heading to its second season, of course, delving deeper into the murky and political world of the Deep State. Having failed in the Middle East, powers now turning their attention to sub-Saharan Africa and the scramble to plunder its national resources and so on and so forth. Is this going to be an accurate routine, or is it Hollywood getting it all wrong again, Justin?
Is your question, does the Deep State exist? Well, I mean, in my experience, if the question is, do I think there's a small group of shady individuals behind the scenes who are pulling the strings, I'm not sure about that. If the question is, you know, does the government and do corporations sometimes go against the overall wishes of the people, well, that's a different question, and maybe we do see that from time to time.
So what are the key skills that people need to be aware of when they're actually dealing with deep spying issues?
Well, I think the skills that the intelligence services look for are the skills that you would expect. You know, is the person good at problem solving? Do they have an observant nature? Are they inquisitive? Do they actively seek out information? Are they discreet? They don't necessarily have to be able to mix a good dry martini or be able to jump out of a plane without a parachute, but, you know, it helps.
Shaken, not stirred. So why is it that we're so fascinated by espionage in general? I mean, this whole thing, it has that. I mean, we were talking about Melissa possibly being a Mata Hari earlier in the production. Is this, you know, something which we're always going to sort of go with and think it's the secret glamour of the spy industry?
I think you're right. We are obsessed. We're deeply interested. You only have to see the number of movies, spy thrillers, books. You know, we're deeply interested. And I think the reason is this, that all of these spy thrillers, they tap into an essential human characteristics. So we see a little bit of ourselves in these when we watch them.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Emma, any questions?
I was quite interested to see that people use social media as finding out who someone's friends are and that sort of thing. I didn't realise that'd be part of it. I mean, I have done that in the past. I have used Facebook and things like that to use
technology
people,
and finding out details.
Interestingly, I was going to ask, do you find a lot of this, I mean, people believing that they find out information the first time, do you think that can lead to pretty dodgy rumours and pretty horrible things?
I think we all have to be careful about so-called fake news and incorrect information. And I think we have to judge for ourselves whether information is true or not. But it's no different whether you're working for the intelligence services as in your day-to-day life. Last night I tried to get my children to bed on time, and they told me that their mother had said that they could watch another episode of the TV show and stay up another half an hour. It turned out to be fake news. So this is relevant to all of us.
These are critical things. Justin, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with you, good self, today. A reminder, you can obviously catch Fox's Deep State Season 2, airing on Thursday nights, 9 p.m. on Fox. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today, Justin Donnelly?
Thank you very much.
Will you come back? That's the next question.
I'd love to.
Whoa! Ah, yes, the theme to a TV series. Well, a kind of variation of theme to a TV series, which probably nobody apart from myself remembers. I Spy, Robert Culp and Bill Cosby. In theory, we should be going, hopefully, to speak to Lisa Faulkner in a few seconds from now. We'll actually say those ultimate words. Lisa Faulkner, are you indeed there? No. Anyway, we'll keep the line open. We'll see what actually sort of happens and see what manifests in its own sort of way. Again, talking about irresponsible dog owners and the fact that in terms of actually sort of feeding food, there are certain things you just would not do in any way, shape or form. And hopefully to address this and talk through the whole process, so you can tell there's all sorts of fun going on in the studios in London, doing all sorts of manner of bits and pieces whilst we're waiting for this to work through, we should be able to actually say, if they're around, Lisa Faulkner, are you indeed with us? No, that's
not.
Hey, hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Do you know, sometimes we feel as though it's like sort of walking up Everest with our hands tied behind our back, but it's worth it. It's worth it just to connect with your good self. We had hoped that William Sitwell would have been your warmer back this morning, but he went into a bad phone zone. But never mind. You know, we can work through that. We've already been shocked in the studio, Lisa, by some of the findings of this particular research, and feeding your dog a Sunday roast is not good. Chocolate, don't do it at all. I mean, this is just shocking, isn't it?
Well, it is shocking in the fact that I think as pet lovers, we feed our animals things that we think that they might like because we think they're humans. And I don't think it comes from a bad place at all. But Royal Canin had done a survey and found out that the average dog is being overfed by 54,000 calories a year, which is just like us eating 402 burgers. So it is quite substantial, the amount of pets that are overweight and are being overfed, but just purely by the fact that we overlove them, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's thing of too much love from that point of view. Ben, were you shocked in the studio by this?
I wasn't. I think it was more the types of foods than food in general. I think food in general, I think it doesn't surprise me because, you know, pets tend to beg and I think people, particularly owners, tend to give in to them just because they feel guilty or they love them or, you know, put a cute face on or can do, you know, raise their paw or something like that. But, you know, I think the types of food is more surprising, especially in some of them obviously quite poisonous to dogs.
Mm.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the fact that owners admitted feeding dogs, I mean, I have been guilty of giving them a crisp, but sausage rolls, cake, ice cream, Chinese takeaway, shepherd's pie, you know, there are sort of things that you go, really? But I suppose people just think, oh, go on, have a bit of this or...
Yeah, but Lisa, let's be honest. I mean, I know that sometimes, and I'm sorry, there might be even a listener to this particular programme that maybe not the brightest spark in it, but if you've got a canine, don't do it, please. Just learn the sort of basic scenarios on that sort of system. I mean, is it just a case of raising people's consciousness and doing as we're doing now and as you're doing across stations, etc., just actually raising the profile of this, or is it a case of, well, that's human beings, they just don't know how to cope?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got Hannah here with me, who works for Royal Canin, and is amazing, a pet food expert and scientist and all these things. But I've learned so much from her that I didn't know. And as somebody who just loves my dog, it has been so fascinating to be able to go on a website and talk about, you know, when you love your dog, it's like loving another member of your family or a friend, and you want to do the best for them. So it's been very interesting talking about how we move forward.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Hannah, briefly, I don't know if you've sort of there from that point of view, listening to this whole system, pet food expert and so on, what is the best way forward? Is it just a case of we need more education?
Yeah, I think education is the key to it, really, because as like Lisa said, I don't think people are doing this because they don't love or care for their animal. It's quite the opposite. But it's actually about respecting the dog that's in front of you and respecting that it's not a human. Yes, it's part of your family. Yes, you can love it. But actually feeding it a diet that's suitable for its individual needs rather than, you know, bits of our diet, Chinese takeaway or any of those things. And just understanding that through giving these treats, you can exacerbate certain sensitivities. So not only is there the weight concern, there's a joint concern as well. Skin, coat, you know, digestion, all sorts of sensitivities that can arise from feeding a food that's not appropriate for a dog.
And as you said, it might well be fun to acknowledge that your dog deserves Christmas presents, birthday presents, and even have your own Instagram accounts. Well, actually, to be fair, Frodo the Pug, actually, Lord Frodo the Pug, our Gibraltarian correspondent, does actually have his own Instagram account. And I do believe that there's even an Instagram account for various dachshunds and folk that are actually around as well. Bean, I think Bean the dachshund is also given an Instagram account. But still, where can people go to find out further information about this survey and more, Hannah?
So if you go to www.royalcanin.co.uk, you'll get lots of information around how to approach feeding your pet and lots of helpful advice in there about, you know, recognising a healthy pet, recognising a healthy weight and things like that. And obviously we've had a lot of press releases out today, so do have a look and seek them out and see what you make of it.
Fantastic. And Lisa, just returning to you briefly, I'll give a shameless plug as well for Meant to Be, My Journey to Motherhood, out in this very month of June. It's well worth accessing.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, it's way forward. I mean, I always find lisafaulkner.co.uk is a go-to website with all manner of wonderful goodnesses in there and treats, etc. Have you both had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme this morning?
I think it's been more than reasonably interesting. It's been fascinating.
So will you kindly both return?
We will.
Yay!
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You cry all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound.
So we say thanks to Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Bobby Seagull, Martin Raymond, thanks to Williams, well, for trying at least, Lisa Faulkner, William Hanson, and of course Justin Donnelly. And in the studio it's been a hearty thanks to Fergus Jeffs.
It's been excellent as always. Yeah.
And to Melissa.
It's been a fun experience.
Excellent.
Sarcasm.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Nice formal wit.
It's Mancunian wit, we go with that. And Emma. And Ben?
Yes, it's been very good, thank you.
Excellent. Don't forget Sound and Country Vision with Tessa Snar and Sister Lois and a whole stack of wonderful guests this evening at 7 o'clock. Lots of great news happening for Siren during the course of the day. Can we say good luck, England? Come on, England. Beat Holland. 1, 2, 3. Come on, England.
Good luck, England.
Oh. This is...